Hi everyone. Thanks a lot for inviting me. It's quite nice to be here. So basically, I'm going to talk about some results that we got in my group in UCL. So in particular, about these two papers. One of them is in collaboration with Misha, who is a postdoc in my group in UCL, and another one is with Jonathan, my supervisor, and with Luis and Chris, who are also, well, Chris is now gone, but they were both in my group when we were doing this. So what I'm going to be talking about basically is within this research program that a few groups are trying to pursue these days, which has to do with what kind of things can we learn from coming from quantum information that are useful in basically thermodynamics for small quantum systems. And the idea is that there's things from coming from quantum information, concepts and theorems you can prove. That basically things like, you know, the idea of resource theories, entropies that you can derive, the results from Shannon theory, like Schumacher compression, things like this. And the idea of recoverability, which is the one I'm going to be focusing on. And the idea is that maybe these things help us to understand things like the non-equilibrium fluctuations of quantum systems. What does it mean to have to extract work in a quantum setting? You know, what are the free energies that are important in the thermodynamics in the quantum regime? And what is the irreversibility that appears to this at processes that are basically thermodynamical processes in the quantum regime? So what I'm going to do basically is I'm going to start talking a bit about some results in quantum information for a couple of slides. And then I'm going to move on to the results in this paper I showed on thermodynamics. And basically, the beginning is just to give a bit of the background of the quantum information side of the story. I guess the central concept I'm going to be talking about is this idea of a reverse map. If you understand a classical map as basically something like this, a stochastic matrix that takes you from a probability distribution to another probability distribution, and you can understand this as some sort of dynamical process. There's a very natural way of constructing another classical process, another stochastic classical process, which you can call a reverse map. And it's this. So given some probability distribution and some conditional probability, so basically I is basically the particular states that a system can take, and j is the same. And this is I for initial and j for the final, let's say, time step. So basically, you can define this other conditional probability, and it's defined this way. You just it's kind of, I mean, it should of course remind you of Bayes theorem, and you know the construction is related to Bayes theorem. And the idea is that if you construct this matrix in this particular way, it takes you from this probability distribution Q, which was the final one, that resulting from this process happening, and takes you back to the original one, which is P. And this you can understand as a time reverse process. And the idea is, well, that is the question we're going to be looking at this. Can you give a physical meaning to this reverse process? And the nice thing, looking at, you know, focusing on the quantum setting, is that there's a very natural way of writing this thing in the quantum case. And this is the quantum reverse map. So if you think of T as a CPTP map and rho some quantum state, T is going to be the analog of this matrix sigma is going to be the analog of this probability distribution. You can construct this thing, which is a quantum reverse map, which is a CPTP map. And it's basically constructed as a series of, so there's three maps that are not trace preserving, but positive. And if you put them all of them together, you get a CPTP map. So basically, you first multiply from both sides by this thing, which is T of sigma to the minus 1/2. Then you apply T adjoint, and then you apply sigma to the 1/2. And the result is a CPTP map. There's a theorem that is what I'm going to talk about now, which justifies, I think in some sense justifies calling this a reverse map, and it's a Petz theorem. And it has to do with relative entropies. This is a theorem from 86. So yeah, take the relative entropy of two states around sigma, defined like this. It's basically, I mean, I guess some of you are familiar with this, but it's basically a measure of a distance between two different quantum states. And there's a meaning you can ascribe to it in terms of hypothesis testing, but this is not too important for now. And this measure has a property, which is called the contractivity under CPTP maps.
Yeah. Just to clarify, is sigma always the same sigma that's using the definition of T? build up, or is sigma general?
So basically, this map, this reverse map, you define it with respect to a particular map T and a particular state sigma.
And all of these sigmas now there on page, this only true for this sigma?
Yeah. So you define the map. So so you define the map in terms of sigma, and the sigma has to be fixed, basically.
Properties for relative entropy. General relative sigma, relative entropy.
No.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so this relative entropy has this property, which is that it decreases under any CPTP map, which basically means that if you apply a particular map to two states, these two states are going to be harder to distinguish. And this theorem basically tells you that when this relative entropy doesn't decrease but stays the same under the CPTP map, then this reverse map basically allows you to recover a row. So this map by construction takes you from the image of sigma, from T of sigma, back to sigma by construction. But then the non-trivial thing of this theorem is that when this happens, this also happens, and if and only if. So basically, when the relative entropy doesn't decrease, there's a map that allows you to reverse this particular instance of a quantum process. Even if the map itself is not a unitary, so it's irreversible, then it allows you to reverse it. So it's kind of basically telling you when a particular instance of quantum dynamics is reversible. And what people were working on lately, well, in the past few years, were approximate versions of this theorem. Basically, the idea is it possible that when this thing is not an equality, but maybe an approximate equality, so when this is not zero, but almost very close to zero, is this approximate in some sense? And the answer is yes. And there's a few.
Can you go back?
Yep.
So the Petz's theorem, that says for each row, the statement is true.
Yeah, so for each row for which this is true,
then
this is true as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you mean to say that if that holds for each row, then there exists some t tilde, and it's sufficient to take the one at the top?
And this is one, yeah. And so actually, this one definitely does it, and there's more that do it. But this one is possibly the simplest one that does it. So the original statement of the theorem is basically about this. Then you can, actually with the recent results, you can prove that if you change this a little bit, this is also true, but I mean, I would say this is definitely the easiest definition of a recovery map.
Another question. So you said this can happen even if T is not unitary, but I guess if the relative entropy distance stays the same for all rho, then probably T is unitary, or?
I guess intuitively, yes. I'm not completely sure, but intuitively, I'm not completely sure, but probably yes.
Another question, so you're not considering this for all rho and sigma, and relative to your old notation, sigma was the state of the input. What exactly, how should I think about rho here? So am I correct to say sigma was your initial state?
So rho and sigma are both initial states here. And the final states are T of rho and T of sigma.
Right. But which, it's not for all rho and sigma. So
you need to have this condition.
Should there be a for all rho and sigma in that condition? Because that seems to me like it would indicate that T should have to be a unitary. So if it's not for all rho and sigma, then what is the quantifier that goes in front of that?
So I guess for all rho and sigma for which there's an equality, so for each rho and sigma and T.
If there exists a pair of rho sigma such that this is
true,
then for that pair.
Then this is true.
But sigma doesn't appear on rho. Oh, sigma appears inside the definition of T. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. I got it.
Yeah, so the theorem is not completely symmetric between the two.
Then the thing I'm still confused about is that the right hand side is being called recovery. But rho is not the state you put in. Sigma is the state you put in. So maybe I'm misunderstanding something.
Yeah. So
I would have expected if you derived an equation that said when I plug in sigma and then I do the recovery, I get sigma back. That I would have called recovery. But
the thing is that happens by definition. So you can always construct a map that takes you from T of sigma to sigma, and this map does it. But the thing is that in addition to doing that, it also recovers rho.
right? So for a given sigma, there might actually be many choices of rho
yep.
that happen.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And you can probably characterize this for particular examples.
Are you going to tell us about the sort of operational significance of this notion of recovery?
Yeah, so in the context of thermodynamics, recovery has a... So this map is kind of easier to interpret. So this is just a mathematical construction in some sense. And in thermodynamics, it requires some a more clear physical meaning, I guess. That's the idea. I guess I'm just trying to justify this map mathematically for now. In this, so it's a recovery map in this particular sense, basically. Is that okay? The extra thing I want to talk about is basically you have this theorem that is basically exact in the sense that equality here implies equality here, and the new theorems, which is basically inequalities like this, tells you that when this is approximately equality, this is also approximately equality. And the way to phrase it is something like this. So whenever you can lower bound this decrease of relative entropy, which we should hear it was bigger. It's always bigger than zero, but you can make this bound better. and what you put here is basically you lower bound this decrease of relative entropy by a quantity that is a measure of a distance between the state rho and how well you can recover rho. Actually, one thing is not that now this is t prime, t tilde prime, as opposed to just t tilde, because the proofs of this theorem are such that this construction doesn't. So the proofs of the theorem construct a different recovery map, which looks a bit. It looks very similar to this, but it has some extra complications. There's a few versions of this kind of theorem, but I think this is the strongest one. And basically, this is telling you that whenever the relative entropy doesn't decrease very much, then you can recover the state rho quite well through this recovery map. This is a general theorem for CPTP maps, and there's some particular instances for particular CPTP maps and particular states for which this kind of theorem is interesting. And I guess the most famous of them is this Fossian Renner result, which is not exactly applying this result to a particular case. It's a bit different, but I mean the bound is of the same kind. Basically, if you choose rho, sigma, and t in a particular way, so t will be the partial trace and rho will be some tripartite state, what you can do is you can lower bound the conditional mutual information. I don't want to go too much into this because it's not really relevant for the rest of the talk, but basically it has to do with how well you can recover from. So if you have a tripartite state ABC and you throw out one of the parts, this is telling you how well you can recover the tripartite state just by acting on one of the systems. I just wanted to point this out, but this particular case is not going to be important for the rest of the talk. But I guess I'm going to get into the thermodynamics part, and the idea is that in thermodynamics, this kind of theorem is going to be useful. So quantum thermodynamics. So I guess the naive idea behind what I'm going to say from now on is that, you know, we've seen some theorems and some constructions about quantum maps that have to do with how irreversible some instances of quantum dynamics are. I guess you could think, oh, well, so in that case, if thermodynamics is something which we study, in which sense are things irreversible, right? How are they irreversible? What does it mean to be irreversible? So, you know, if you apply these theorems in the context of thermodynamics, do you get interesting things? The point I want to make is that, yes, basically. So I'm going to be looking at two kinds of processes. So first of all, by thermodynamics, I mean situations where you have some quantum system with a bunch of energy levels, and you make it interact with some heat bath, with some fixed temperature beta, and you extract some work. I will get into this construction a bit more in detail later. So I'm going to be talking about two kinds of thermodynamical processes, ones which are basically situations where the system is equilibrating with an environment, with a thermal environment, and situations where you extract work or you expend work. Of course, they're all related, but I just want to point them out separately. So first of all, equilibration with environment. So you expect that when you have a quantum system coupled to a heat bath, weakly coupled in this case, it's gonna equilibrate with this heat bath and it's gonna tend to the thermal state. And there's a way to model this, which was first constructed by Davis in 76, And you can show that from a Hamiltonian, from a weak interaction Hamiltonian between a system and a bath, doing some approximations like rotating wave and some more Markov approximations. You can get to a dynamical evolution for your system, which is described by a Limbladian equation, which has the, so which, it has some unitary term and some dissipative term. This is the Limbladian part. And it's such that this equation has a stationary state, which is the thermal state of the system. And this is the Hamiltonian of the system. And the thing is that this kind of Limbladian has a very interesting property, which is the one that connects with the recovery map business. And it's called detail balance. So there's a notion of classical detail balance, which is this thing I'm writing here. So you have a state, some probability distribution P, which is going to be the steady state of the evolution. So imagine a classical evolution that has a steady state P. If it obeys this classical detail balance property, what it means is that the conditional probability that represents this dynamical evolution is such that this and the transpose are related by this ratio. And going three slides back, what it means is that the reverse evolution is basically itself. And in the quantum regime, this is basically the same story. So the Limbladian, this Limbladian here, this dissipative part, has a property which is, you can write it like this, which basically means that if you choose, so the sigma from three slides before now is going to be tau, but because it's the fixed point, so let me see. So now I'm going to choose this as the fixed point of the map, right? So basically, so this instead of T of sigma is going to be just sigma or tau because it's the thermal state. So this Limbladian has this property, which is that basically that it's its own recovery map when you choose sigma to be the thermal state, of course. And I guess the way to interpret this condition, so it means two things. It's a property of how a system reaches equilibrium, and it's also a property about equilibrium itself. And you can see it from this thing. So if you have a system in thermal equilibrium with its thermal bath, you're going to be doing some sort of jumps between energy levels. And the idea is that if this equilibrium has the property of detail balance, you can record a film of what's going on at the equilibrium, and then you can run it backwards, and it's going to look the same. This is what this equation means, basically. And in the quantum case, this is the analog.
But when you say that the recovery map equals the original map, by the original map, you meant LD, the Limbladian?
Yeah, okay, so the unitary part here is not super important, but yeah, it's only the dissipative part that is equal to the recovery. I'm gonna basically disregard this part for now because it's not too important. In the next slide, I'm not gonna consider it. You can rewrite things including this, but it's just a bit more awkward. Basically forget about this thing for now, because the important part here is this one, which is the one that tells you how you reach equilibrium. Okay, so basically given this thing. Can you prove something useful under the light of these recovery theorems that I mentioned before? And we prove something. And what we prove basically is a stronger version of the approximate recoverability theorem that I showed earlier. So there's a quantity here that is kind of quite important in this context of Davis maps, which is the entropy production, which is basically the difference of relative entropy after some time t. And you can write it now, instead of being relative entropies, this is basically a difference in free energy. And it's called an entropy production because, maybe I write it here. So this difference in free energy, I can write it like this. Can I write here, is that okay?
Yeah.
So this difference in free energy is equal to a difference in energy minus 1 over beta, a difference in entropy. And the thing is that because we're in the context of weak coupling with a thermal reservoir, a change of energy in the system is equal to a change of energy in the bath. So this is equal. This is actually the same as delta Q, which you can understand as the change of energy, actually minus delta Q, a change of energy of the bath. And because the bath here is very large and it's a thermal system, this basically is equal to 1 over beta change of entropy of the bath. So this and this basically give you this delta F, and it's basically the total entropy created in system and bath down the process. And it's basically a measure of how irreversible this process is. So basically, we can give a lower bound to this quantity. And the lower bound is basically the relative entropy of the original the system at time zero and the state after you evolve after time 2t. So these two basically comes from the fact. So this is the theorem I was showing earlier. This is stronger because the relative entropy is bigger than minus 2 log f, which is going to have some significance. And the truth here comes because of this fact that recovering in this context is basically the same as going forward because of this property here. So it's kind of a weird thing that, you know, in this context, recovering is basically, you're not really recovering, but you're actually going forward in time. So with this inequality, we relate the entropy production at time t and how much the state changes at time 2t. the evolution is Markovian and all that, but we're relating to the states of the system at two different times, which maybe is kind of, it's not so clear why you're able to do that, I guess. So just one more comment about this. What we're trying to get with this inequality, I'm not sure we have actually used it in its full potential yet, but I will explain why do I think it's important. So basically, what you can see, so before we had just minus 2 log f here, and here we have relative entropy. The nice thing about having the relative entropy is that the bound is tight. And it's tight in the sense that when you approach the equilibrium state, so when the system goes to the thermal state, which is the fixed point of the evolution, this inequality turns into an equality. So basically, how different these two numbers are is telling you how close you are to equilibrium. this is a plot of this bound. So the blue curve is this one, and the dashed curve is this one. And you can see that for long times, they basically converge to the same thing.
Question.
Yep.
Why do you call it tight? Because it sounds like it's, you should know that it's tight in limit that your states are thermal.
Yeah, okay.
In general, it might not be tight. In fact, I think it'll be far from tight.
You're right. I mean, it's maybe, I'm not using the word tight properly, maybe. So it's with tight, I mean that at equilibrium is gonna, both things are gonna be the same. So basically, the idea is that this inequality we've proved from ideas from recovery maps is telling you something about how these evolutions converge to thermal equilibrium. In this context, there's kind of an important question, which is how long does it take for a particular amount of time, for an initial state, how close you are to equilibrium. And there's some techniques that people have for deriving basically bounds on how close you are to equilibrium. And they have to do with spectral gaps of the Limbladian and logs of Levy inequalities. There's a few techniques. And one hope that I had, I think we haven't fully explored it yet, but we haven't really done, it's kind of work in progress, I guess. It's seeing if this inequality allows you to get something like what you get with spectral gaps and things like this, which are basically bounds on given any initial state, how close you're going to get after a certain amount of time to thermal equilibrium. Yeah, this is work in progress, I guess. So basically, the idea is that in this context, these recovery maps give you some nice insight of, you know, how systems thermalize. So that's all I'm gonna say for this part. Now I want to get into the work part. So a bit more into the resource theory framework of thermodynamics. to model quantum thermodynamics, we use this concept of coming from quantum information, which is a resource theory, which has to do with a particular set of maps that you call free operations, and the way you want to say things about what these operations do, what is the power that you're allowed given these operations, and things like this. So in the resource theory framework of thermodynamics, we were able to do things like tracking the energy and the entropy and the coherence that is transferred between different systems. And the different systems that we consider in this context are basically some system with some Hamiltonian, which is going to be just a bunch of energy levels that has some populations, a big thermal bath with some background temperature, beta, and some Hamiltonian. And also now something that I'm bringing in now, which is a weight, or a quantum weight, it's kind of probably the biggest idealization of this model, but it turns out to be useful. you have to think of this as a, as a quantum system that has basically a lot of energy levels, in such a way that it has all the possible energy levels, in such a way that you can find any energy gap that you want to find, you can find it. So it's basically some sort of like very dense ladder. and we're going to be looking at maps, which are basically global unitaries between these three things. And the unitaries are going to be restricted in two ways. One of them is energy conservation. So basically, this unitary is going to, we impose the condition that it's going to have to commute with the sum of the three local Hamiltonians. So H is the Hamiltonian of the system, H of P is the Hamiltonian of the bath, and HW is the Hamiltonian of the weight. And the total unitary is going to commute with all this. And the idea behind this property is that, we want to keep track of all the flows of energy, entropy, and coherence. And this is the thing that guarantees that this is going to be the case. Because if this rule didn't hold, it would be because there's maybe another system that is bringing in the extra energy. And then you have to take this into account in order to account for all the resources, I guess. Yes, and there's another constraint in the unitary, which is a bit more subtle, which has to do with a problem that is very pressing in quantum thermodynamics, which is how do we define work? So there's a very recurring problem in quantum thermodynamics, which is that work seems to be a bit of an elusive thing in this regime. So classically, in all the thermodynamics textbooks, you think of work as something like some sort of weight that you basically take from here to here. So there's like a fixed amount of energy in this example, gravitational energy, and it's basically a fixed amount. And this is important because work is defined as an ordered amount of energy. But the thing is that this notion of work as a definite change of energy is not necessarily so useful in the context of quantum thermodynamics because fluctuations are going to be more important. So you want to be able to include in your model things that are basically, so I guess, processes in which work is a thing that can fluctuate. So you're going to have things like probability distributions of work. So for a particular instance of a thermodynamical process, you're going to be, instead of this process involving some definite amount of work, you also want to account for situations where the work is not a definite amount of energy, but like some probability distribution over values of the work, basically. But this is an issue because, of course, if the difference between heat and work was that heat is ordered and work is not, and here I'm saying that work can actually fluctuate, how do you distinguish the two things? And this is kind of, I'm not sure this problem has a fully definite and neat answer, but we try to give one, and it's by constraining the unitaries that we consider in the resource theory. And what we consider is that the unitary commutes with this operator, which is it's an operator that basically lifts the energy of the weight. So this delta W is in some sense so you can relate this operator and the Hamiltonian of the weights by some commutation relation. Almost in a way that is reminiscent of the bosonic operator, for example. But it's not quite the same. But basically what this does is if you apply this delta W to the weight, which is for example here, in the state that is basically this energy level, you're gonna raise the state to something that is basically above by some amount of W. And the idea is that what we impose in these operations is that the unitary commutes with this. And what we want to do with this is that we want to recover one of the properties from that classical work has. And this property is that, so we want to consider work to be something that is about, it's not about the initial or final states of a process, but it's about the process itself. So what we achieve with this is basically that the amount of work that we extract in a particular instance of a process is going to be independent of, for example, the state of the weight. So if the weight is here, and you do the protocol, then your weight is going to be taken here. But if it's in a different place, the weight is going to be taken to a state that has the same, for which there is the same energy difference, basically.
Why is this equivalent to you commuting with the Hamiltonian for the weight?
It's not exactly equivalent. I think this is
like, what is delta W? Maybe I don't quite like. I know you say it's the state of the weight, but it's got to be an operator.
Yes, so delta W is an operator.
So what is it doing?
Yep. So basically, take your weight in the ground state, for example, in the ground state 0, and you apply delta W to it. It basically takes you to the state W. So it's really what this operator does is raising the energy of the weight. That's all it does.
And so what's HW?
HW is the Hamiltonian.
Well, I know what it is, but why isn't that, like, I would have thought delta W is taking some state to a different state, but that's what the Hamiltonian basically.
Oh, no, but the Hamiltonian, I guess I'm referring to eigenstates of a Hamiltonian here. So the Hamiltonian, for example, what it will do is.
So delta W is a raising or lowering operator for weight, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe it's a bit of
okay.
It's a bit more tricky, but yeah, basically what we achieve with this definition is this notion of the work as something that is independent of initial state and it's about the process. Because the idea is that if I wrote 0 here, but I could have written anything else. I could have written maybe some W sub 0, and here instead I will have this. And this holds no matter what this number is. The important thing is that this W is the same as this one. I mean, maybe it's a bit of a formal thing, but what comes out of it is a nice characterization of the operations. Okay, so this is basically the setting of this research theory of thermodynamics. And really the new thing that I'm introducing here from previous works is this thing, this definition of the work. Now I'm going to write one of the things we prove, or the more general thing we prove. So I can take any process, which now I'm going to label this T of S and W as the marginal on the system and the weight of the global unitary, a unitary like the one here. So basically, I get the system here, the bath, which is in a thermal state, and the weight, which is in any state. Because the state of the weight doesn't matter, that's the idea. And this is the map. And I'm going to call it a forward map. And then I can define another thing, which is the backwards map, which is basically the same thing, but with a U dagger instead of U. So it's another thermal operation with the same, so it belongs to the same set. But it's the reverse in the sense that the global dynamics is reversed, right? So instead of U, you have U dagger. So it's the time reversal in this particular way. And the nice thing is that in this context, because of all these things we impose, this thing coincides with the best recovery map. So these T forward and T backwards are the recovery map of each other if I construct it in this particular way, which basically, now I have, again, a construction which is three maps. So the backwards map basically is the first multiplying from both sides by this thing, which is the Hamiltonian of the system, and this is the Hamiltonian of the weight, to the minus 1/2. Then I apply the adjoint of the forward map, and then this other map, which is H of S plus H of W. And the three things are a CPTP map, but they're not just any CPTP map. They're the backwards map. And this, basically, the idea is that you can understand this as a quantum group theorem. So I'm gonna elaborate a bit more on this now. But it's kind of a non-trivial connection between this notion of reverse and this notion of reverse. And the thing is that the idea is that you can derive a lot of things from there. And this is the next slide. So one thing you want to be able to do with this thing is to talk about the quantum fluctuation theorems. So quantum fluctuation theorems have to do with basically, you have some quantum system and you apply some thermodynamical process to it and you extract some work. You want to understand things like, what, you know, in this setting, what is the quantum part of this? And the thing is that in the more classical literature of fluctuation theorems, what people do are things like basically measurements at the beginning and at the end. So to get a work distribution, what people were doing in the past were things like, you know, I have a system, I make an energy measurement to it, and then I do something to it, and then I measure it again. And with this, and by comparing the initial and the final measurements, you can get some work distribution. But the problem with this is that basically because you're measuring at the beginning and at the end, you're getting rid of too much of the quantum part of this. And this is something we kind of wanted to avoid, and it's one of the things we're trying to answer with this, with this kind of framework. We don't have the full answer yet, I think, but there's some things you can say. So, of course, this is a fully quantum identity, and you can look at, you know, the coherence part of this quantum identity, coherence understood as coherence in the energy eigenbasis. And there's a paper by Johan Haber where he elaborates a lot on these things, but I don't want to get too much into that. Beyond that, and I guess what I want to say now is that this is a quantum identity, but actually the part we understand better and the part where you get the most like interesting results perhaps is when you look at the classical part of this quantum identity. So because of some property of this thermodynamical maps, it has to do with the asymmetry property that they have. You can decouple the classical part, understood as the classical part basically is what tells you how energy populations behave, as opposed to how.
I was just going to ask, does all this require like infinite-dimensional baths and weights?
Okay, so the bath doesn't have to be infinite-dimensional. You want to consider baths that are infinite in a particular way to have the full power of the resource theory, but. That's not important. The weight, on the other hand, is a trickier thing, yes, because if you want to have all the possible energy gaps, you're gonna have a Hamiltonian that maybe is unbounded from below, so this is not so easy to define. So actually, this expression is true, but formally, if you take it fully seriously, it's a bit harder to interpret this. This H of W it can be a bit tricky. It can be a bit of a tricky thing because this fact that it may be an operator that is unbounded from below. But the point is that in any thermodynamical process, you're not gonna actually use the minus infinity part, I guess. this is a bit of a tricky expression actually, but the expression is for sure true, and you can derive things from it. it's because the weight I was talking about is a bit of an idealization, and if you want to actually look at particular settings, you're gonna have to, I guess, do a bit more work connecting the idealization with the actual model of work extraction. This is a thing that is useful at maybe at a very theoretical level for now. What I was saying is that this thing, you can basically decouple what these maps do to the populations in energy and what they do to the coherences in energy. and the things that the part of the map that is easier to interpret is what it does to the populations in energy. So now I and J are going to label energy eigenstates of the system, that have energy EI and EJ. So these are energies are going to be the energies of the Hamiltonian of the system. And basically, you can associate a particular conditional probability distribution. So this map is going to be associated to a particular conditional probability distribution, and this one as well. And basically they're related through this way. So the one associated to the forward map is related to the one associated to the backwards map in this way. And I mean, it basically comes out of this. basically the idea is that the two things are related by this exponential thing, which maybe should be reminiscent of something that appeared a few slides ago. There's this thing which is a thermal factor. So it's e to the beta of the energy of the final state. Final state understood in the forward sense. So the forward takes you from the initial to the final, and the final is labeled by J. And EI is the initial energy. And W is an independent random variable, which is independent of the particular I and the particular J, and it's basically the work that you extract in a particular instance of the thermodynamical process. And I don't know if it's surprising or not, the fact that here I'm including I here as the thing we condition on, and J as the final one, and W is also here. And the fact that W appears here and not anywhere else has to do with this thing that we impose of, you know, this basically this thing that W is going to be a thing that has to do with a particular, no, it doesn't have to do with initial state, but it has to do with the particular instance of the process. So the fact that it appears here indicates in some sense that the definition of work that we get through the condition goes in the right direction. And from this from this identity, we can derive a lot of things just by manipulating it in quite simple ways. one of them is this thing called the Crookes theorem. So if I start my forwards and my backwards process in a thermal state of the system, I'm going to extract some work distribution. And this is basically this P of W. And for the backwards process, the work distribution is the P of minus W. And this has a minus because the set of W's that you extract in the backwards process are basically the same as in the forward, but with a minus sign. And what this theorem is telling you is that the work you extract in the forward process, as compared to the work you get in the backwards process, is suppressed by an exponential factor. And it's an exponential, it's e to the minus beta W. So basically, extracting work is exponentially suppressed with respect to getting work in the backwards process. And this has to do with the fact that you've started in the equilibrium state of the system. So you shouldn't be able to, because you're starting in equilibrium, on average, you shouldn't be able to extract work. And the way in which this happens is basically this, that extracting work is exponentially suppressed with respect to getting work. This is what this is telling you. And these sets are just the partition functions of the system at the end and at the beginning of the thermodynamic protocol.
Can you repeat the definition of P forward of W? That's when the initial state is what and the final state is what?
So the initial state of the system is thermal. Mm-hmm. So what you input here is a thermal state in the system, but and anything in the weight. So you input
anything on the weight.
Anything on the weight and the system in a thermal state.
Okay.
In the thermal state. And in the this is this one. And in the backwards process, you have to do the same. You have to input the thermal state of the system. This doesn't
final state. Those ones upstairs, you assume you started in an energy eigenstate I and you ended in an energy eigenstate J on the system. But in that second equation, you assume you started in a thermal state of the system. And then you maximize over possible final states?
It's for any process, you're going to get to another state that is not the thermal state.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really matter what it is, as long as the initial one is thermal. So, and then you do two things. You do a forward map and then a backwards map. And in both, you start in the thermal state. So you prepare the thermal state, you do the process, and then you go somewhere else, and then you reset to the thermal state, you do the process, the backwards process, and then you compute these two things, and they're related by this. I mean, it's kind of simple to see how this follows from here. So basically, these thermal factors here are going to correspond to the initial probability distributions of the. So you can think of this. So this E of I is going to be the initial probability distribution that you condition on, and this one goes to the other side. So this follows very simply from here. And I mean, this is a very simple expression, but it only holds if you impose this condition that the initial states have to be thermal. A bit of a caveat of Crookes' theorem. And from this, you can derive also Yarshinsky's equality, Yarshinsky's theorem. I mean, all you have to do for this is basically, you know, take this to the other side and, you know, and basically average over W. And you get a very nice identity, which is basically the average of exponential of the work equals the ratio of the partition functions at the end and at the beginning of the process. And the nice thing about this kind of expression is that it's telling you something quite simple and nice about the irreversibility of about the second law and work extraction as constrained by the second law. Because one thing you can do from this thing is that you can use the convexity property of exponential to derive an inequality, and this inequality takes the form of an upper bound in the amount of work that you can extract. So for a process in which you start in a thermal state and then you do something to it and you get some work distribution, the average of this work distribution is going to be upper bounded by this thing. And in particular, if the Hamiltonian of the system doesn't change, this is going to be zero. So basically, the average of the work distribution is negative. And this is telling you that if you start in equilibrium, you can do something to extract work, but on average, you're not going to extract work. You're going to extract a negative work. But the thing is that These are probably the simplest expressions we can get from this, but you can get a lot more. And in particular, you can get this one, which is maybe, yeah, it's kind of interesting, I think. And it's what we call the second order equality. So you can define a random variable, f of i, and it's defined through basically a particular energy of the system and a particular probability of your initial configuration. And it's such that when you take the average, so when you average, when you multiply times p of i and then sum over i, you get the free energy. the Shannon free energy, I guess, the classical free energy. And you can compute this for a given protocol, no matter what the initial state and the final state. You can compute this thing for the initial and the final state, and you can basically define this random variable, which is just the f of j. So f of j is basically this thing, but applied to the final state. f of i, which is the same thing, but well, basically this one of the initial state, and then w, which is the work that you extract in a particular instance of the operation that takes you from a state that is described by p of i to a state that is described by some other distribution, which is the one that is included in this random variable. And the average of the exponential of this thing equals to 1. And one important thing you can note from here is that the same way we can use the convexity here to derive this, we can use the convexity of exponential here to derive this thing, which is really what the second law is. So the second law, it basically tells you that in a particular process, the work you can extract is upper bounded by the difference in free energy. And this is even if the work fluctuates. And it turns out that in general, this bound is tighter than this one. So there are cases where these two numbers coincide, but it's very rare that they coincide. And when not, they don't coincide, this is a better inequality. And also, this one only holds when the initial state is thermal, and this one holds for all initial states. So it's a bit more general in that sense. And this expression basically is telling you something stronger than this inequality. It's telling you that in a particular instance of a thermodynamical process where you do some transition, so you have a system in some energy state, and you transition to another energy state, and then you extract some work in the process. there's going to be particular instances of this. So if you do the experiment many times, you're going to get some statistics. And in some cases, you're going to see that the second law is broken. So this thing is broken. And in other cases, it's not. And the average is such that the second law holds, of course. But this is telling you something else. It's telling you that these occurrences that break the second law are exponentially suppressed with respect to the ones that don't break the second law. So it's basically very similar to these things, but maybe in a bit more general in that sense, in the sense that it holds for an initial state and so on. So if in the Maxwell's daemon kind of setting, for example, so in the Maxwell's daemon setting, basically you have you're a daemon and you're like in between a hot and a cold gas, and you want to there's going to be points in time when there's a very energetic particle coming from the cold part of the gas to the hot part of the gas, and in these terms you want to open the gate. So what this kind of thing tells you is that the equations where the daemon wants to open the gate are exponentially suppressed with respect to any other equation where the daemon decides not to open the gate. so I guess that's this kind of more quantitative statement is what makes this kind of expression interesting. And these things are called this average of exponentials of things are called the integral fluctuation theorems. And there's a few more you can write from this thing, and they take different forms. okay, so and one last thing I want to mention is more about this is more of a technical slide about the resource theories. The resource theory is modeling thermodynamics. And the thing is that we can kind of establish some sort of hierarchy of resource theories of thermodynamics. And there's three that I want to mention. A first model of a resource theory is one of noisy operations, where basically the operations are you have a system, and what you can do to the system is bring in some noise and do any unitary. So the resource in this context, in this resource theory, is purity. And well, the idea is that basically you're modeling thermodynamics in situations where the Hamiltonian is, well, basically you don't care about the energy. It's just noise and purity that you care about. That's why in some sense you impose that the Hamiltonians in this context are just the identity. And basically what happens is that in this resource theory, you can define some stochastic matrices that represents the processes of this resource theory. And there's going to be a constraint in these maps, and this constraint is by stochasticity, which is this thing here. Basically, you know, because the matrix is stochastic, the columns add up to one, but this also means that the rows add up to one. So, so the stochastic matrices are such that rows and columns add up to one. Basically, given this, you can write the necessary and sufficient constraints for transitions between states. So basically, if I give you two states, and there are conditions telling you whether you can go from one state to the other by an operation like this. And in this resource theory, the conditions are majorization. Majorization of the spectrum of the density matrices involved. So if you have a density matrix with some spectrum and another one with another spectrum, and you compare, well, basically you check majorization for the two, you have an operation that takes you from the initial to the final of this form if majorization holds, basically. And this has to do with the fact that the operations have this constraint. There's a slightly more elaborate model of a resource theory of thermodynamics, which is the next level, which is the one of thermal operations, where you consider basically that the environment you can bring in is thermal and it has some Hamiltonian, and you do unitaries, and these unitaries have this property I mentioned before of conserving energy. And in this context, you're kind of bounded to consider work as a fixed or deterministic quantity. So you're bound to consider work as a particular energy, that energy change in a system. So basically, a work will be just going from here to here, and you get the gap, and this is the work, as opposed to the work distributions that I was talking before. And basically, the idea is that in this context, these operations also can be written as stochastic matrices, and these stochastic matrices obey a condition, which is this one, which is more or less equivalent to the Gibbs state being preserved. But I mean, I prefer to write it like this. So basically, I add an extra factor here, which has to do with the exponential of the energies. And what happens in this context is that the constraints for transitions between different states are something else that is called the thermomajorization, which is basically a generalization of the conditions of majorization. Maybe I can, I mean, I don't know if you can ask me about this later. It's a bit tricky to explain in a few words. But it's basically majorization with respect to, instead of with respect to the maximally mixed distribution, with respect to the thermal distribution. And what the resource theory I was talking about here is a bit more, it has some extra things. So it's a bit more tricky, and the reason for this is this fact that we've introduced this fluctuating work, and this introduces some complications. And now basically the operations I allow for are basically the unitaries that conserve energy, and I can act on a weight, and I act basically with this constraint. This is the additional thing, and basically it's the same as in thermal operations, but now I allow for a work to be a fluctuating quantity. And the constraint I get here for the stochastic matrices is a bit different. Basically, I have to include the work here, and I have to add over the work. And this constraint also follows from this thing. So if you add the, how does it work? Yeah, if you sum over, okay, maybe it's not something. Well, if you add over a couple of variables here, you get to this thing. Yeah, so this is basically the constraint on the stochastic matrices. And it's the same as this, but with this extra W. And I guess the open question in this context is whether there's an analog to this. Is, I mean, this is kind of an interesting open question, maybe, in this context of resource theories. Whether there's an analog of majorization and thermomajorization, where you include this extra random variable, which is the work. I'm not entirely sure this is a possible thing, but who knows? It's certainly not, as far as I know, it's not this kind of question is not in the standard majorization literature that I've encountered. But maybe it's an interesting one from the perspective of thermodynamics. And yep, with that, I'm going to conclude. So Well, basically, I started with this idea from quantum information, which is a question of how well we can recover quantum information, understood in this particular way of recoverability theorems. And, and there's a fact, which is that this recovery map that you define in information theory seems to coincide in some way with notions of reverse, of like the detail balance condition that appear in thermodynamics. So a way to phrase this that I like is that the ideas, the notions of informational and thermodynamical irreversibility or reversibility seem to coincide in some way. I mean, maybe it's not such a surprising coincidence, really, but you can get some nice insights out of it. Well, I guess the claim I've been trying to make is that with this thinking of recovery maps and things like this, you can say useful things about things like equilibration with the environment, our processes where you strike work, and you can say nice things about the second law and in which sense are quantum thermodynamical processes irreversible. And basically this has some consequences for, you know, for dissipative processes and dissipative processes modeled by this quantum thermodynamics, this resource theory, for example. And I guess, well, the general point I want to make is that maybe there's this new thing coming from information theory that is helpful in thermodynamics. And the general message is that I want to make the point that there's something coming from information theory that is useful in thermodynamics. And, you know, this is maybe an example of more things, right? Like, you know, we know that the idea of resource theory is coming from information theory is useful in thermodynamics, and now maybe I can say that the idea of a recovery map is useful in thermodynamics, and maybe there's more things beyond that. And yeah, that's it. Thank you very much.
So you didn't mention it explicitly, but we only know the conditions for transitions if the roads are quasi-classical.
Yeah.
So there's actually a lot of work to be done there.
Yeah,
as
that's
well.
True.
And I just wanted to verify that it's also true that all the results from the previous slide are fluctuation theorems. Those were also all assuming quasi-classical states, road, diagonal, and the energy.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, well, even if they have coherences, you don't care about them. I mean, you just look at the diagonal, right, of the process. So the states don't have to be diagonal, but you can just decohere them and nothing happens. Right?
Now, when you say you can just do that, do you mean that you can prove that coherences don't help you with work extraction, or what exactly do you mean?
You can prove that, yeah. So if you have coherence and you don't have a reference frame, this thing basically tells you that the W's are going to be the same whether you have coherence or not.
But I could have a reference frame.
Okay, in that case, then I guess maybe this changes a little bit. Or so if you have a reference frame, you cannot. You have to take into account the coherence, right? I guess. So you cannot just go straight into writing these matrices, right?
So there could be a generalization of everything here.
Yep. And this is
coherences.
And this, I mean, this is kind of the big game behind. Yeah. So in the end, we want to understand what is quantum about fluctuation theorems. And I guess with this kind of thing, we only give a very partial answer, because really what we understand is the diagonal and the energy. And you can write an analog of this for all the diagonal modes. So in this paper by Aber, that's what he does actually. So he writes something like this, but not for the diagonal, but for the off-diagonal modes. But the problem is that you cannot really write the work here. It's a bit harder to interpret. So because you don't have probabilities, you have something else. You have some amplitude of some sort. So you can write this thing. Basically, you can write this thing in terms of modes of coherence. But then writing work, if you consider this modes of coherence, is a bit trickier. And one way in which it's trickier is because if you don't have a reference frame, you cannot extract work from the coherences. I guess we haven't fully gotten there. I think there's still work to be done in the sense in the direction of fully quantum fluctuation theorems
I would say it differently. I would say there's really nothing very quantum about this at all, because all the quantum states are essentially just probability distributions over energy. So,
okay.
So we still don't really have anything in the way of intrinsically quantum fluctuations there. So.
Yep, that's what's true.
Okay. So I have another question about that last slide on resource theories. So I imagine that there's sort of another step you could squeeze in after noisy operations,
yeah,
which would be the analog of what you've done. So I understand your sort of new set of free operations as you've got a bank from which you can sort of extract work and put work in.
Mm-hmm.
And the weight. And that's what allows you to do a broader set of operations, and you just have to keep track of what's happening with the weight, which is why you include it in the final state. You know, you have to keep track of how much work has happened in the transition. But couldn't I do something similar, even though the Hamiltonian is trivial?
Uh-huh.
I could say, look, I've got a bank of negative entropy. I have to keep track of how much negative entropy I've extracted and how much I've put in. And so because the majorization type relation is actually much simpler than thermal majorization, it's an easier problem to attack rather than the one that you listed there.
So that would be basically a resource theory where you set all these things to zero, or to some number.
So it would take that equation that you wrote, but replace it with zero. So now it's like the top equation, except you've got this exponential factor. So it seems like more tractable is something to.
I think you may be right. The problem is that when you I don't know if the problem, but a comment on that is that when you talk about working noisy operations, you're not talking about the energy difference. You talk about things like these sharp states, right? So you talk about states that have some maximally mixed subspace, right?
Mm-hmm.
and not about energy changes of a weight, right? So
it wouldn't be a weight anymore, but it would still be a path of.
Okay, maybe some combination of sharp states or something.
Sorry?
Yeah. Are you thinking about some?
Yeah, sharp states.
Hmm. Okay, I haven't thought of that. Maybe that works. Maybe that works. I don't know. And I guess maybe it will look like what you said of setting these things to zero. Yeah, maybe you can formalize that. Something to think about. More questions?
So let's thank Aura again.